Good morning, everybody. Okay, I'm feeling so much better this week. If you heard me last week, I was croaking like a frog up here. My voice is still kind of, you know, a little bit raspy, but I'm feeling so much better. So awesome to be back here and have another shot at maybe getting my voice across to you. I want to start by telling you a story about my daughter, Leilani. She was about 4 years old, and we were at this Japanese restaurant. We're sitting up at the counter, and we order something baked. I think it was like baked scallops or something, and the chef takes it and puts it down in front of us, and he says, the plate is very hot. Just come out of some oven where it had baked. It doesn't look hot, you know, but it is hot. And he puts it down, and I see her looking at it. She's kind of a stubborn little girl. She's looking at this plate, and I said, baby, don't touch that plate. She looks right at me, reaches forward, and puts her finger right down on the plate. So all of a sudden, she jumps back, starts staring at her finger, and then a blister starts to appear right on the end of her finger. I said, could we have some ice, please? I took care of her. Well, you know, there's something about that, isn't it? When you tell someone they can't do something, that makes us want to do it. Just hearing that there's some boundary we're not supposed to cross, we wonder, hey, what would happen if I broke the rule? Is it really going to be so bad? Maybe I'm going to be happy, we think. And sometimes boundaries do that. They keep us from things we want, that they're there, but you know, we know that if we cross the boundary, we might actually enjoy what we're going to get on the other side of it. We think because we use boundaries that way a lot of times in our lives. Like food, we're not going to eat, you know, because we're trying to lose some weight. So we say, I'm drawing the line. At dessert, I'm not going to do it. Oh, wait, it's cheesecake. Wait, no cheesecake. I'm not going to have cheesecake. But not because cheesecake is bad. That's not why we're saying it. We draw a line because it's not bad. Because if it was bad, I wouldn't need a line to draw. But it's not bad. It's not all bad. That's what we mean. It's only kind of bad at certain times. So now my kids, they're getting ready to go to college now, a couple of them, my daughters. And when you get older, one of the great things about going away to college, in case parents are not totally aware of this, but I think you probably are if you remember back, is that you get to do anything you want. I mean, that's kind of one of the exciting things about going away to college and not being at home when you're going to college. You don't have boundaries. You know, you can eat anything you want. You can eat junk food all the time when you go away to college. And you can stay up all night. I can remember staying up 3 o'clock in the morning watching Perry Mason on this little TV in my dorm room and thinking, this is awesome. Just because I could. You can go to parties. A lot of people end up, you know, wasting their entire first year at college because of this phenomenon, because they don't see it as an opportunity to do something good for themselves. They see it as a chance to cross lines without anyone to tell them that they can't do it. And we come to believe that this is what's important in life, that we get to do whatever we want. And we think that's what life's all about. That's how I get happy in life. And I think it's one of the reasons why Christianity is appealing less and less to young people today in our culture, because they think that it's a way to stop people from doing whatever they want. But then we look out at our culture, a culture that thinks this way, and it's never been in bigger trouble than it is right now. We have an escalation in pornography worldwide, $5 billion industry. We have violence against women. It's been escalating for decades. It's kind of flattened out this last decade, but it's been growing at a scary rate. Self-esteem is dropping. Polls are showing that self-esteem is dropping across the board for young people. 70% of young women now experience low self-esteem, and of the ones that do, they are 75% more likely to engage in self-destructive behavior. We live in a culture where people are empty. Marriages are failing. The marriage rate is actually dropping, significantly dropping, because marriage doesn't offer a lot to people who just want to do whatever they want. It means fewer options for people, so you expect it to drop. Each year, more than 1,800 college students die from alcohol-related accidents. 1,800. Nearly 600,000 college students are injured while drunk, according to the Journal of Studies on Alcohol and Drugs. 696,000 college students are assaulted by another student who's been drinking, And 97,000 college students every year are victims of alcohol-related sexual assault or date rape. 97,000. How do we speak to young people going out into the world of our time so that they can see what the world's perspective is doing to us? Our lack of limits is not working out. We think that having the most options leads us to happiness. We all think that, not just young people, that boundaries stop us, but we're not happy. We're not happy. The people who are best equipped to find that kind of happiness, Hollywood celebrities, are miserable. We think they have wonderful lives. Then we read stories about them drinking themselves to unconsciousness and passing out every night. Drinking isn't what they're doing because they're happy. It's what they're doing because they're not happy. And they want to stop feeling that. That's why they do it. You'd think the lessons of their lives would send us in the opposite direction, that we look at these people and think, I've got to just do the exact opposite of what the celebrities are doing if I want to have a good life. But instead, we keep thinking we'd be happy if we were like them. Harvey Weinstein. This comes out. It's the real story behind the Hollywood life, people. It's been covered up, but it's there. It's always been there. There's nothing to stop it from happening again. It's part of that life. And now, finally, even Hollywood is taking a stand against things that he's done. But he was Hollywood. Hollywood has no solution. It can't explain why we shouldn't end up on that path if we don't get caught. Hollywood can't explain why Hollywood is wrong. They can only just say how horrible, with no solution. But we can explain why it's wrong. We can. So our lack of boundaries, it's leaving people emptier, more in pain, instead of finding our way to a different perspective in our culture, thinking this isn't working out. We assume there's nothing better than this, and we just keep trying to push the limits. That's what's going on. More booze and sex, more meaningless spending on things we don't need, and our culture's heading for a cliff. And all the while, across 2,000 years, the words of Jesus Christ still speak to the hearts of men and women and offer them the life they really need. That's what we're here to talk about today. Jesus said, I have come that they may have abundant life. Something different than what the world offers is what I offer. That's what he said. So how do we find our way out of this crazy train wreck and help our young people find their way out of it and experience the life that he's talking about? That's what we're talking about this morning. We're in a series called Questions. We've been talking about different topics. These are topics that you guys wrote down on pieces of paper, and several of the pieces of paper that were written down and submitted were about, hey, what about Christianity and sex outside of marriage? And what about, you know, Christianity and alcohol and Christianity and gambling? What do we do with these things? So I'm going to answer these questions today in the context of this talk. I got nominated for that. Not maybe the topic everybody wants, but I got it. And how do we make sense of Jesus' perspective in today's world? You know, I'm actually really happy to talk about this. And is this an old-fashioned system, Christianity, that doesn't apply to people today? Is it intended to take away our fun? These are the kind of questions we're going to answer. And the text I'm going to be looking at, I'm going to be looking at two passages out of Paul's letter to the Corinthian church. And let me give you just a little quick background on this church and why this is such a perfect example for us to think about for our own lives. This church, this is a church in Greece, and so it comes from, you know, a long and ancient Greek culture, very sophisticated and also morally very open to just about anything, to the point where they have prostitutes that work in the temples of the gods in this city. So they believe in many gods and they have temples to them. And some of these temples employ prostitutes as part of their worship. And some of these men now are in the Christian fellowship and they've turned away from this polytheism. And now they've become Christians and they're in the Christian assembly. But they're still going to the temples and having sex. And they're saying, what's the big deal? We're not worshiping the gods. We know they're not real anymore. We're just going there for sex. And it sounds a lot like people in our time. What's the big deal? You got to chill on me with all these rules about Christianity and sex. It doesn't sound fun to me. Wait, Christianity? This doesn't sound fun. Sounds like I'm not going to have fun if I become a Christian. Why don't I get to do whatever I want? I mean, what's the big deal? So they're having a lot of problems in this church. That's why he has to write this letter, Paul does, to try to help them see things a little bit differently. They're having difficulties combining this worldview that they've lived in with their Christian faith, just like we do. Our culture today, it's on a similar course to this culture. And here's the thing we know, okay? Because we know about that culture that Paul was writing to. We know that that culture is about to go down the tubes. That's part of the Roman Empire. That culture is crashing and burning on its corruption. But it's hard for them to see because they're in the middle of it, just like it's hard for us to see in the middle of our culture. Everyone around us is saying, hey, life is about your choices. Do what you want. Have sex with anybody you want. Don't feel guilty. You want to drink alcohol? Drink as much as you want. Just don't drive on the road. But otherwise, you know, have a great time. It's the same thing that's been said for thousands of years, people. This is not their culture, our culture. This is all cultures. So Paul is going to write a letter to these people and explain it to them, to these Christians in this fellowship. Probably a group, you know, 300-400 people that he's writing to. How do you explain to the kids going off to college why not to get drunk every night? And why not cross whatever sexual line you want? What do you say? Do you say, hey, here's the rules. I'm your dad. Don't break my rules. Is that what I say to them? Is that going to work? If I say, I'm going to get mad if you guys don't do what I tell you, is that going to work? It didn't work when my parents said it to me. Why would it work when I say it to them? So Paul's writing to this church, and he's got to reach them, and he's not going to talk to them that way because that's not going to work. And hopefully as he speaks, he's going to reach us also. And he uses this big picture. He wants to paint a big picture because that's the first step in helping people to see what they've bought into as a lie, is to help them take a step back and look at it differently. It's a model that makes sense to them. This is a culture that invented the Olympic Games. So he uses a metaphor wrapped around the games to help them step outside of what they have been taught to see so that they can see it differently. So let me read to you, 1 Corinthians 9:24. Do you not know that in a race all the runners run, but only one gets the prize? Run in such a way as to get the prize. So this is his first point in trying to help them see, is that the point is your life has a purpose. That's what he's trying to get across to them. Your life has a purpose. People don't live like their life has a purpose out in our culture or in their culture. They live like they've got time to waste. Like the days don't make any difference. I'm living for the moment. If you're living for the moment doesn't mean anything. It's just how much fun can I have at this moment? Life is short and then you die. That's what we think. You better have fun. Doesn't mean anything. Just have fun. Live for the moment. Living for the moment means there's no bigger purpose. You just need to enjoy yourself until life is over. And that's how the world lives, for the moment. Only how I feel matters in that perspective. And if you live enough moments and the moments are all zero and they don't mean anything, then you reach the end of your life and your life doesn't mean anything either. And so Paul even kind of takes this approach when he's talking to them later in the book in 1 Corinthians 15:32. He says, if the dead are not raised, there's no purpose, then let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die. Well, you may as well. If that's how you view life, that has no purpose, then having rules or boundaries, it doesn't make any sense. Those stop you from living for the moment. Just do whatever you want. Time's running out. Have fun. That's what people are being taught on every major university campus across the United States. You're just a machine. You're just a random product of an accidental evolutionary process. You don't have a soul. You're not coming back from the dead. You better just have as much fun as you can while time is here. But if your life has a purpose, then just doing whatever you want doesn't make sense at all. The moments of your life should add up to what your life is all about. So Paul uses this idea of a race to explain our lives have a purpose. We're here for a reason. They're about something. There's a goal to your life. There's a finish line to that race. Everyone who's in a race is in the race for a reason. So everything you do is about the race and should line up with crossing the finish line. And that means you head in a certain direction in your life. And it means you don't get sidetracked. You start thinking, well, my life's about having as many choices as I can. But in a race, you don't want choices. Choices might mean I'm confused about which way I need to go to reach the goal. I just need it marked out for me. Because that's the only thing that matters is that I get there and get the prize. That's what this is about. It means you don't do whatever you want if you're in a race. That's not consistent with the goal of the race. And it means that sometimes it's hard work. It's not all about just having a good time if you're in a race. The purpose of your life is something bigger. And if it is, you should live the best life you can to reach the goal. Because people who don't get the prize. Back in 1924, there was this man, his name was Eric Little. He was the fastest man in Scotland, this guy. He had this crazy unorthodox running style, so he got a lot of attention. As he ran, he would kind of throw his head back and open his mouth and just start running, just crazy. But he was really fast. So everyone came to him. Now, he had a heart to go to China as a missionary. But the people of his country said, you got to compete in the Olympic Games. The Olympic Games are coming up in Paris, and you can win the 100 meters. You're that fast. And so he says, okay, I'll do it. So as he's preparing to compete in the 1924 Summer Games, turns out that the qualifying heat for his race is on a Sunday. And the man says, the Sunday is the day I give to the Lord. I don't run on Sunday. And the people are like, what are you talking about? You need to go through the heat or you can't qualify for the Olympics. He says, I'm not doing it. Nobody can talk him out of this. He is not going to do it. So in the final equation, they say, okay, why don't you run some different races? So they put him in for the 200 meter, okay? And he loses to the Americans in this. It's not his race. It's too long for him. So then it comes down to the 400 meter, which is a long race for this guy. And his times previously weren't that great. But he's going to run in that race because he refuses to cross the line on what is important to him. And one of the American runners is a Christian and hands him a piece of paper before the race with a quote from 1 Samuel chapter 2 where God says, he who honors me, I will honor. So this guy gets into the 400 and they put him in the far outside lane. He gets the worst lane. It's the lane where you're up front so you can't see anybody else running next to you for the entire race except up right when you get toward the very end. So he has no idea how to pace himself. And he doesn't really know this length very good. So he just starts thinking, I'm just going to run as fast as I can for this entire 400 meters. That's not normally how you run this kind of race. Okay? But he did, and he broke the world record and got the gold medal. Eric Little. He said, it's been such a pleasure to compete in the 1924 games, but I've been competing in a race for my entire life. And the one who gives out the medal at that race is God, and that's what I live for. Your purpose is seen, and that movie, by the way, it was made into a movie, Chariots of Fire, won Best Picture in 1981, if you haven't seen that movie. Your purpose is seen in your priorities. What is the purpose of your life? What are you running for? The world tells you you have no purpose. Just make yourself happy. You're just a machine. You're just an accident. You have no value. Don't worry about your body. Give it away. Have fun. Well, it's a lie. And you'll never have the life you're created to have if you believe that lie. Second point here he makes is your purpose is realized the moment you stand at the finish line. Verse 25, everyone who competes in the games goes into strict training. They do it to get a crown that will not last, but we do it to get a crown that will last forever. Okay, so the crown he's talking about is that garland. It's that victor's wreath that they put at the heads of the people that win. It's what you receive at the end of the race. It's what the race is all about. It's all about the wreath. The day I stand there and Jesus puts a wreath on my head and says, well done. Now think of that moment and put yourself there that moment. Because you're going to be there standing before him. And it doesn't matter who you are. There's nothing you can do to stop that. That moment will come. The only question is what he will say when you reach that moment. So pretend like that moment isn't coming and you have all the time in the world. That's what everybody's doing. Everyone's thinking that way. But instead, picture yourself at that moment and think about what you're going to say to yourself. Are you going to say, you know, I should have watched more TV? Is that what you're going to say? I should have goofed around more and gone to more parties. I took life way too seriously. Or I should have drank more beer. Man, I could have drank so much more beer than I did. I blew it. I should have bought more stuff. Or I should have been looser with my sexuality. I could have had sex with so many more people. No, you're not going to say any of those things. What you might say is, why didn't I try harder? And why did I waste so much time? Why did I cross so many lines instead of standing strong for the Lord? Why did I listen to the things that Hollywood told me I should do? No race makes any sense without the finish line. Finish line is the completion of the race. It's why you're in the race. It's not an expiration date to your life. The finish line isn't the end of you. It's just the end of the race. It's the end of this life. Greater things are ahead. That's what the finishing line means. You need to picture yourself at that moment and think about who you are. This is what we all need to do and what our kids need to do. Picture who we will be when we cross the line, because you're not an accident. The world tells you that you're an accident and you don't matter, but you do matter. You have infinite value in the eyes of the Lord as you serve him. Third point Paul makes, you were built to run. You're built that way. God made you who you are to live a certain kind of life. You're not made to just do whatever you want. You're made for a purpose. If you do the thing he made you to do, you will have the life that he intended for you to have. It's not the life that the world tells you to have or that Hollywood tells you to have. That's not the life you were made for. It's the opposite of that life. If you try to go for their version of the good life, you're going to end up with problems, with emptiness, and all these train wrecks that we're reading about. So this is what Paul says in verses 26 and 27. He says, therefore, I don't run like someone running aimlessly. I don't fight like a boxer beating the air. No, I strike a blow to my body and make it my slave so that after I've preached to others, I myself will not be disqualified for the prize. So there's no point in self-control in the world that's out there. If you live for the moment, self-control is worthless to you. Nobody talks about self-control out there any longer. But there is value in a life where you are straining toward the goal. Because running means progress to an end in your life. And there's no race where you just go any direction you want. You go any direction you want, you'll never finish. If you're a boxer, you don't swing anywhere you want. You won't hit anything. If I just swing at the air around me, I'll just get hit. That's what's going to happen if I'm a boxer. You're never going to have the life he made you to have if you don't make the choices that line up with who you are and who he's made you to be. The prize is for those who run to win, and that's what you were made for. You were made for that moment when you cross the line. If you do whatever you want, you're just going to end up with the same thing everybody else has. because that's what they're doing. Same addictions, same unhappiness, and same emptiness. But we make excuses. So you think, wow, this makes such sense, but we make excuses. Why we should just do the same thing as everyone else? We still believe the lie, even Christians. It's hard not to. We're surrounded by it. Hollywood bombards us with it. So we find ourselves caught up in it all the time, and we make excuses. And this is what the Corinthians were doing, because they don't want limits. They want to do whatever they want. They want to live like pagans, like life is all there is. And one of those areas is sex. They have a very lenient attitude towards sex. So they want to say, what's the big deal? Why so many rules? It's the same thing people are saying today. I was reading one article which was talking about Christian values, kind of mocking them, saying that to the degree that Christian values of modesty and abstinence come up, they're characterized in this article as examples of Puritan prudery aimed at spreading misinformation and shaming teenagers into thinking sex is dirty and will ruin their lives forever. Is that what we're doing? Is that why Christians think sex is reserved for marriage? Because we think it's dirty? And we want to tell young people that they should live that way to shame them? Is that what we're really doing? Is that our goal? Well, Christian views on sexuality, they make no sense in our culture. People have concluded because of our values that Christianity's oppressive, that it's that God's not fun, and he's not out there to let us have fun, and we think rules are bad. But I want to adapt a C.S. Lewis analogy to help us picture this differently. Picture a movie centered around people removing their clothes. That's not difficult to picture in our culture at all. And people sitting there and watching that movie can sell millions of dollars of tickets. These movies sell tickets all the time in our culture. And picture people just watching going, wow, they're going to take off more clothes and just getting engrossed in the movie. Picture that. Picture someone from another culture, maybe another planet, watching us in our theaters, just so thoroughly engrossed with this. And imagine what they're thinking. But stop and let's picture us watching a group of people in a theater. Only the movie they're watching is about food. Food comes out and it's covered with these different cloths and coverings. And as they start to slide the cloths away, everybody starts to get really excited and start drooling, going, oh, show me more of that bacon and the legs of lamb. And everybody is so excited and they're selling millions of dollars of tickets to this movie as they reveal food. Now picture that, and we're watching these people. What are we thinking? Aren't we thinking, what's wrong with these people? What, are they starving? Isn't that what we're thinking as we look at them? We're thinking something's gone wrong with their normal appetite for food. And wouldn't they think the same way watching us about our appetite with regard to sex? Something is broken in our culture. It's broken. Men and women, they feel empty. And we're using sex as a way to fill that emptiness. But you can keep pouring into it no matter what your limit, and you're never going to fill it because it's not the thing you really need. We've lost the ability to see what's happening and that our values have led us to this spot where we are so hurting, and we have to overindulge to find any kind of meaning or happiness at all. But the version of happiness that we see thrown at us by Hollywood leaves us emptier than when we started. We stuff ourselves with all this junk and we end up emptier than when we started. What we understand, what Paul's trying to picture, is that like an athlete, limiting ourselves is good for us. They make us fulfilled. They make us healthy and they help us to win. So here's the first excuse that they're using. The first excuse is, I have the right to do whatever I want. That's what they're saying. And you can see that. Now, we're skipping back earlier in the book. He does them in reverse order. First, he covers the excuses, then he gives them the solution. But here's what he writes in 1 Corinthians 6. I have the right to do anything, you say, but not everything's beneficial. I have the right to do anything, but I'll not be mastered by anything. See, because not everything we want is good for us. You're built to have a certain amount of food, right? A certain amount to be healthy. Stuffing yourself. Have you ever stuffed yourself and felt good? Felt good after, just felt like, wow, I ate way too much food. And when we do that habitually, It hurts our lives. And it's easy to see because it's on the outside. We're coming out of the holidays thinking, man, I got to do the opposite here for a little while. I'm hurting myself. But so you can't see your soul and what you're doing to your soul when you live inappropriately, when you cross the lines that God has made with regard to your soul. When we engage in sex outside his plan, it's harder to see the damage, but we can see it in our culture all around us. Despair and depression and low self-esteem and emptiness. If you treat yourself like you're not God's child, like you're not infinitely valuable in his eyes, if you don't see yourself as a person worth having a lifelong commitment before you give yourself away sexually, you devalue yourself and you're hurting yourself. This is the thing that our young people need to understand. We're hurting ourselves by living this way. You're not a prude for seeing yourself as valuable and worth a commitment for someone in their lives. You're made not to give yourself away, but to live in a loving, lifelong commitment with another human being. That's what lifts you up and helps you have the life you were meant to have and built to have. So don't think of it as breaking a rule. If you think of it as breaking a rule, you're going to want to break it. Think of it as reaching out and putting your soul on a hot plate over and over and over again every single time you cross a sexual line you're not supposed to. You're not made for that. Second thing here, Paul says in response to this, I have the right to do anything, is I'll not be mastered by anything. Now, some of the things we do, they control our lives. So we see addictive behaviors wrapped up with all these things we're talking about, alcohol and sex, gambling, but really anything that you're using to make yourself feel better. Could be anything. And we think having lots of choices makes us free and leads us to happiness. But it's not true if the things that you're choosing are bad for you and control you. When you don't have limits and you think the road to happiness is indulging yourself, you become controlled by it because it doesn't actually meet the need in you. So you have to keep going back over and over and over, and it never delivers. If you can't stop whatever it is in your life, and you can think for a minute, what is the thing I can't stop that I know the Lord doesn't want for me? Think a second. If you can't stop, you're being controlled. Christianity, what it is, it's the way to have the life you're meant for. It's not about rules and regulations. It's not about giving something up, or at least not giving something up that you need. It's about giving something up that takes life away from you. Second excuse they make. What does it matter how I live if this life is temporary? So the Corinthians, they believe, and they come from a culture where they believe that the body is kind of not important. What matters is the soul. That's Greek philosophy. They believe the body's just kind of dirty, and it's the soul that matters. So they think, you know, what's the big deal? And this is why Paul has to talk to them about the bodily resurrection later in this book, because they're struggling with this idea, like, why would God want to bring back my body? My body's dirty. All I want to come back is my soul. The body's temporary. So if your body's temporary, what does it matter what you do with it? That's the thought. And we have the same problem in our culture. We devalue our bodies. It's for a different reason. It's not because we think that the soul is more important than the body. It's because we think we're just machines. I just come from evolution, you know. Billions of years ago, I was just some blob. And then over time, you know, I've turned into this person, but I'm just a blob. My body's not important. What does it matter what I do to it? So what does it matter if I cut my body or pierce my body or tattoo my body or if I pickle my liver with alcohol or if I take substances and put them into my body or I starve my body? What does it matter? But we're whole people. That's what we understand in Christianity. We're whole people. That God made all of us for his purposes, our body and our soul. So this is what Paul's saying here in starting in verse 13. He says, you say, food for the stomach and the stomach for food, and God will destroy them both. The body, however, is not meant for sexual immorality, but for the Lord, and the Lord for the body. By his power, God raised the Lord from the dead, and he will raise us also. Do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ himself? Shall I then take the members of Christ and unite them with a prostitute? Never. Do you not know that he who unites himself with a prostitute is one with her in body? For it is said the two will become one flesh. But whoever is united with the Lord is one with him in spirit. Okay, so here's what Paul's saying to these people. He's trying to get them to think of this differently. You're not, your body matters. It's meant for the Lord. All of you is meant for him. The Lord saved the whole of you, and he wants all of you. Resurrection shows the body is not temporary. You're going to get this body back. I don't know if that's good news to you or not. It's going to be better. Even if it disintegrates, he's going to bring it all back. He's going to fix it for you. But you're going to get your body back, just like Jesus did. So you don't use your body for evil. It doesn't make sense. The body's also how I serve Jesus in this life. We're members of Christ, Paul says. We're part of the body of Christ. We participate in his service with our bodies. Why would you take the body you have in his service and connect it to some sin and misuse it? So the term one flesh that he uses here, this is from Genesis. This is God's plan for a man and a woman and a lifelong loving commitment to be there for each other. It's a connection. It's not just a physical connection. It's a connection in your soul with another person. It's where our whole idea of soulmate comes from. But it's not some thing that we have to figure out in life or we're looking for or hope. It's what happens when you really give yourself to another person unconditionally in life. You connect at that level. That's the one flesh picture. It's meant to help you in life to be in that connection with another person. That's what marriage does for you. It helps you in life. It helps you to become the person you're supposed to be if we do it God's way. But we misuse it when we misuse our sexuality and we hurt ourselves. So we connect ourselves to sexual partners. And we're doing it not just physically, but in our souls. That's what Paul's saying. And that's the place where we're connected to the Lord also. So why would you do that? That's what Paul's saying. You're not made to be drunk or to have sex that undermines your value as his child. You're made to run. You're made to have a goal. And you should control yourself and not do what everyone else does because it's not leading us to the lives we need. So we should run to win. We should set boundaries in our lives to reach the goal. Boundaries help you. Saying, this is my limit. That's to help you, not to hurt you and to rob you of anything. So if you say, hey, I'm having sex with a lifelong partner, that's not being repressed or a prude. It means you know who you are and you value yourself. That's what we tell our young people. And by saying to someone else, hey, I'm not going to have sex with you, means I'm valuing you also. It doesn't mean I'm a prude or I'm repressed. The Christian view is that we're created as sexual beings and that sex is good when it's used the way it was intended. It's not a limitation on sex, how much sex, how much pleasure you can have. It's a limitation on who you have it with. That's it. Who you have it with. You can manage that boundary. That's all it takes. That's what I tell the kids. Same with alcohol. You can drink, but you stay in control by avoiding being drunk. That's the biblical picture. Because when you drink, just because you're unhappy, you can end up an addict. It's the same with gambling or shopping or whatever we use. And we all use something at times when we're not happy. If you put the Lord in the center and you live for him, you can have joy. And you don't need those things. So you set limits to them in your life, and don't let yourself be controlled. So he says, flee from sexual immorality, but not because God doesn't want you to have fun, but for these reasons. Here in verse 18, flee from sexual immorality. All other sins a person commits are outside the body, but whoever sins sexually sins against their own body. Do you not know that your bodies are temples of the Holy Spirit who is in you, whom you have received from God? You're not your own. You are bought at a price. Therefore, honor God with your bodies. This is important, the point he's making here. I'm not going to go into detail on this, but it's easier to sin if you think you're just breaking God's rules. I think that makes it easier for us because we think, of course I'm going to break God's rules. He's perfect. I can't be God. Why even try? But if you think of it as sinning against your own body, it means you're going against being that person that you were meant to be. And you can be that person. You're hurting yourself and preventing yourself from the life you always wanted if you sin against that. And you want to be that person. You do. Not the person Hollywood tells you to be. When Christians share sexual values with young people, it's not to shame them. It's to help them see themselves as people who have value and to view their sexuality as important, not a casual thing, but an important thing in who they are. By maintaining boundaries, we choose life and we protect ourselves from harm in the face of a culture that will devalue us if we listen to them. These boundaries don't limit us in any way from having all the great things that God has planned for us in sex. They only limit the damage that can happen if we don't use it the way He intended us to use it. So Jesus didn't come to repress or shame anyone, did He? He came to offer life. He said, "I have come that they may have life and have it to the full." That's John 10:10. What the world offers with its unrestrained life is not life. It's something offered instead of the life that Jesus was talking about. This is what we have to share with the world. Their life is a substitute, a way to compensate for not having the life that Jesus is talking about. We look for a way to dull the pain and distract us. That's the life that the world offers us. But what Jesus was offering was the thing that we're built to have, the thing we're made for. And it's the thing that brings fulfillment for us. We don't give something up when we accept. We gain something when we accept His offer. It's not just an idea for young people, though, with all their options. It's for all of us, because we all have this temptation, all bought into this lie, constantly controlled by it. I spent years of my life thinking I could find happiness out there somewhere if I just kept looking and trying hard enough before the Lord finally reached me. And what the Lord wants from all of us is to think about why we are here, what is our purpose, and to think about that finishing line and the moment that we're going to be standing there and what our lives will mean when all the moments are added up. What will they total out to be? What is holding you back from the life that He wants for you? What is it? We need to think about that. What is controlling us? What lies we're believing? Now, I don't wonder that a lot of people in Hollywood right now are thinking, how did things get this bad and out of control? I'm sure a lot of people are thinking about it. And sometimes in our lives, we reach those moments where we realize, wow, my life is out of control. And we need to look up from whatever is in front of us. Because sometimes the moments that we're focusing on are so important to us. And all our attention is on them. But then we'll reach those spots where we all of a sudden stop and look up. And we remember that there's something bigger going on than just the thing that's occupying us. Maybe this is that moment for you to look up and to turn your eyes on the goal and run to win. That's what you were made for, to run to win. And that might mean making some changes so that when we get there on that day, we're not ashamed of how we've lived. The Lord is calling you to that life, to honor God with your body. He has promised, "The one who honors me, I will honor." Let me pray. What an example of that man's life, Lord, and what he did and the decisions he made and then going on to serve you in China. Lord, help us to have a picture of our lives, a big picture, and to break outside of the lies that we're told and surrounded by, Lord. You know how hard it is. But maybe this is that moment for all of us, Jesus, where we look at what's controlling us and we choose the life that means something. and set some limits in our lives that are taking away life from us so that we can have the joy and the peace and the fulfillment that you offer. That's the life we want, Jesus. Help us to put our feet on your path and head to the goal. In your name, amen.